Civil Law Committee will come to order. Can I have a motion for the minutes of February 26, 2014? Representative Rosenthal has moved the minutes from February 26. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Can I have a motion for the minutes of February 28, 2014? Representative Rosenthal moves those as well. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal, for your participation in the committee today. I know that won't be the limit of it. The first bill that we're going to... Is Representative Halverson here? Oh, here we go. There we go. Are you ready? Okay. The first bill we'll have up is House File 2598. Representative Halverson. And if your testifiers can be prepared to proceed. Members, we do have floor at 9:30 today, so our committee time is cut a little bit short. So I want to get going and move on this. Representative Halverson has an... One moment. And you also have Pat McCann, Ron Elwood, and Mark Anfinson who want to testify on this. There's an author's amendment to House File 2598 labeled A14. Chair moves the A14 amendment to put the bill in the form the author desires. Is there any discussion on that? Then all in favor of the A14 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill regulating self-storage came to me because I have a number of these self-storage facilities in my district. And if you guys look around, you probably will see a fair amount of these. I notice them more and more now that I've started working on this particular issue. There's about 800 self-storage facilities in the state, and we all know the ones with the big orange doors. I'm finding a lot of these are mom-and-pop shops and family-owned businesses, and they came to me and asked me if I would help modernize some of the statute that was enacted about 25 years ago. There's not been a whole lot of change, and there has been a lot of change in how the industry works, and so we're trying to catch up a bit. Self-storage is the rental of space. It sounds obvious, but a lot of folks think it's the unit itself. It's actually the rental of space with inside the building. And the owners of the self-storage facility have no access or interest in what's inside of it as long as it's legal to be inside of there, so no hazardous materials. A person could not live inside of a self-storage facility. But other than that, the owners of the storage unit never take possession over the goods. So it's different than traditional warehousing. The state's lien law comes into play when somebody stops paying their bill. There's currently the only way that they can get their stuff out of storage is to pay the bill or the goods get sold at auction. And when the lien law kicks in, there's a two-step process that first the consumer is notified, and then second, the public is notified of an auction. This bill enables the storage operators, like the six operators in my district, to use cheaper and more effective notification options, and frankly, more convenient notification options for a lot of folks. A lot of people are preferring to do their business electronically. Consider how many people get their bank statements electronically. This would allow, if the customer wants, them to be communicated with electronically by the storage business. Additionally, it updates how we communicate by verified mail, so verified email and verified USPS mail. It's more cost-effective and has become the standard as opposed to certified mail, which was the standard back when this bill was initially enacted into statute. So the operators can set up email if the tenants opt in. I think that's really important. It's the tenant's choice. And if there's a disclaimer, kind of like when there's online banking within your rental agreement. We also give the businesses additional options for posting public notice of the auction itself. Currently, the law states that they are required to pay for legal notice in a newspaper twice. And we'd expand that to also allow, in addition to newspaper, they may use other means of public posting. So a public website, sending emails to people who have attended auctions in the past. The bill also clarifies for consumers what the timeline is for selling their merchandise, or their merchandise, their possessions. We put in clear guidelines in the statute that the sale can't take place until 45 days after the initial default, which is a total of 52 days after the customer stops paying. And if it's a car or a truck or a boat, something that has a title attached to it, the law would state that they have to wait 60 days to have it towed off of the property, and then it's part of a mechanic's lien. So that's not something that would necessarily go to auction at the site of the self-storage. So that's a basic outline of the bill. As you can tell, because we had a DE amendment, this is a work in progress. We've shared the bill very early on with Legal Aid, with the Newspaper Association, and are continuing to work with folks that have concerns about this bill. We want it to both protect the consumer and modernize this particular law. Because of the 24-hour notice, there's a few things that we will be working on for future committees, one of which is dealing with active military, making sure that they're protected because they're in a little different boat in terms of communication, and as well as allowing for additional contacts on a contract so that we have multiple points of contacts for folks. So somebody who may have a parent in a nursing home whose things are in storage, or somebody who has a child in college who tends to be a little more transient. So additional changes will be coming to the bill, no doubt. This is the form it is in now, and we are committed to continuing to work with all parties. So I'm happy to walk through it point by point, or we can hear from testifiers.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Howison. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howison, thank you. I'm just wondering why you're reducing the time from 15 to 7 days.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, and I can ask my testifier to speak on this as well. We reduce the time that you actually go into default. It's still longer than other types of defaults that you could go into on other loans that you would need to pay or your rent. So it's a week longer. And then we add the 45 days on the back end for when you could actually sell that. So it doesn't change essentially when your goods are going to get stored or sold, but it will essentially change the date when you start the default. And there's still kind of a week lag time between a traditional default and this particular kind of default.
Representative Halverson, let's move to the testifiers. Sir, would you please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony?
Patrick J. McCann, Carr Lake, Minnesota. Chair, committee members, I am here today as a small business owner in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to thank you for taking the time to hear this bill, which is very important to me personally, as well as a small business owner, but also to the hundreds of self-storage operators around the state. I'd like to thank Representative Halverson for taking the time to offer this bill and really learn about our industry over the last several months. As I stated, I'm a resident of Prior Lake, Minnesota. Our company owns and manages Metro RV and Mini Storage, which is comprised of four self-storage facilities, one each located in the following cities in the state of Minnesota: Bloomington, built in 1988, Eden Prairie, built in 1994, Mound, built in 2005, and Orono, built in 2012. We employ five full-time managers, two part-time assistant managers, and we also work with District 287 Interconnect program, providing paid employment for those students as well. I'm here today representing the Self-Storage Association as well as a current board member. We represent, as Representative Halverson stated, over 900 self-storage facilities in Minnesota, encompassing 39,587,000 gross square feet of storage space. We rank 23rd in the nation with the number of primary facilities. About 10% of these are large publicly traded companies, and the other 90% are locally owned small businesses within your districts. There are over 350,000 self-storage customers within our state. 76 counties throughout the state have a self-storage presence. Our industry employs over 2,364 employees, including our industry employs 2,364 facility employees, excluding off-site management, not to mention the number of vendors that we hire to provide trash, snow, maintenance, and lawn care services. Self-storage facilities like mine are only regulated by you, the state. We're not federally regulated. We adhere to the state's lien sale law, which was enacted in 1988. Our industry, business practices, and consumer preferences has changed as we've been given new tools and technologies. This bill helps modernizes and streamlines our law within the 21st century by eliminating costly and ineffective notifications and advertising mandates. By being able to communicate to consumers and the public in a more effective way, we not only save money, but we streamline the way our businesses are conducted. I think it's also important to note that my goal and the industry's goal is to always work with the consumer to have them pay their bill or some portion of it. When we sell the goods at auction, it's a lose-lose. We typically only get 20 cents per dollar on the dollar that we're owed, and sometimes if we get $200, we're lucky to retain $40 in rent or in profits at the auction. And as we stated, negotiating with the consumer is always the best route to go. Additionally, when we can't reach the consumer and have to sell their items at auction, it's always our goal to get as many people there bidding as possible. The more competition there is, and the more likely we are to recoup at least part of what we're owed in late rents. The additional provisions in the bill help clarify and draw bright lines in the law for me, the business owner, and my customers. Many of these changes are simply updating a statute to align with current business practices and consumer expectations within the 21st century. I'll be available for questions and do my best to answer questions about the bill if you'd like me to go through the summarize.
Thank you, Mr. McCann. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, you said it was a work in progress. Is this bill going to another committee, or where's it headed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, we do have additional committee stops, and I just realized how early it is and how little coffee I've had. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but I know you moved to the bill, and it's being re-referred to.
It is being re-referred to Commerce and Consumer Protection, Representative Halverson.
Okay, and then if I might, I'm not understanding. On page 2, you talk about verified mail and that the service provides evidence of mailing, but I'm not sure that that includes evidence of receipt. And then when you go down to lines 23 and 24, you give a time frame of 14 days after delivery of the notice, and so I'm a little nervous, and I seem to remember talking to a lobbyist nearly a month ago about this bill, but I would much prefer some type of proof that the notice was actually received, and I don't even know that if those two things go together, because if you say 14 days after delivery, but you have no record of delivery, if you're using a snail mail or just a certification of or evidence of mailing under verified mail, I'm not sure. Maybe you could explain how that even works.
Representative Halverson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, snail mail has changed a bit since this statute was first enacted, and so verified mail actually is part of the first class mail system now, that you verify that the USPS verifies that the mail is delivered, and if it's not delivered, it's returned to the sender, so that you know that your notice wasn't received by the consumer. And then additionally, the same is true for email. That's email is also verified.
And Mr. Chair, if I might then, why in your definition of verified mail do you not specify that there has to be evidence of receipt?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, from what I understand, the verification of receipt is that it is not returned to the sender.
Mr. Chair, I understand that part of it, but in your definition of verified mail, you're silent on the concept of delivery or receipt. You're only speaking to the evidence of it being mailed.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, verified mail is a standard that is the USPS standard. It's not a standard that's in our statutes, if you will.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, if we're enacting law and if we feel it's important that delivery, evidence of delivery of this notice is important to the concept of effective notice, then I don't really care what the Postal Service, how they define their mail. I think we as legislators should define the standards of practice, because as we know, the post office could change their definition.
Representative Holberg, House Research might have some input on this with respect to the sections we're looking at. Ms. Mullen?
Chair and Representative, on the bottom of page 2, line 33, line 32 and 33, it indicates that it shall be presumed delivered when it's deposited in the U.S. Postal Service. It's not included in the verified mail definition, but it might provide some explanation of what they were anticipating.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to spend a lot of time. I know we're short on time, but I, as one legislator, would think it's important that I don't believe that something is presumed to be delivered when it's deposited. Some others may have more, supportive of the effectiveness of the Postal Service than I am, but
I'd like to
see that you have to actually have that it was delivered.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, I guess where I come from, I know you said that this is a work in progress and there's many things coming from the military side of the House to try to protect them. I'm very concerned about the time frames that are in this, because many folks that are serving can't even get to their email within the 7-day or the 14-day period. And also the definition that you're going to use between active military, does that include the National Guard and Reserve that may be not only not on active duty, but also just training for 9 months somewhere? So there's a lot of things that I'm concerned about that I can't see, and when I can't see it in the bill, it raises a red flag to me that it may not be taken care of. So I'm looking forward to that language. But and also there's your time, and that's what my main concern is on the time frames. I guess I would like to know why in 4.31 and 4.33 we deleted that section about negligence of the storage facility. Why are we taking that liability out of the statute?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, that piece of the liability agreement, and one of the things that I neglected to mention is that there is currently a cap on what you can recover from what's in your storage facility, and the cap is $5,000. So if for some reason your goods were damaged, your maximum recovery is $5,000, and we changed the statute so that folks can recover more than that if they put a rider on their insurance policy. The fact is we're not in a position where these are storing precious works of art for, you know, that's not what they're made for, that's not what they're designed for. And we want folks, if they have more than $5,000 of merchandise in their storage facility, to be able to insure for more in the event that there is a fire, tornado, whatever it might be. So, and there are, I believe, and perhaps research can confirm this, other parts of the statute that deal with liability.
Representative Howe, and after Representative Howe, we're going to do one more question from Representative Anderson, then we're going to move on to the other testifiers due to time.
Well, I'll come back that I'm not satisfied with when someone's negligent. I think they're negligent, and I think they should be held liable, and I don't think we should take that out of law. But the other question I have is then when we look at, is there a reason why the notice is a minimum of 10 point? Why isn't it a minimum of 12 point? As you can see, as we get older, I got to put a set of cheaters. This is 10 point. I can't read this without my cheaters. I would think that if we're going to put it in bold, that we should put it in 12 point, because I can read 12 point without my cheaters. I would like to see. I don't know. I guess my question is, why did we pick 10 point? Did that come out of the sky someplace that everybody can read 10 point?
Mr. Chair, I think you raise a good point with those of us who are aging, and perhaps as the baby boomers continue to age, we'll have more standards that are 12-point, but that is just consistent with current law, that most other fringe is 10-point.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, I concur with Representative Holberg's remarks on this verified mail. As a person who's been caught in this situation, I live in a townhouse association that's got 30 units. Three of us are Andersons. One of them's gone for the winter. I got a phone call. Got a phone call from somebody within our Minnesota government a couple months ago. They said, "We sent you something twice 2 months ago." I said, "I didn't receive anything." Mm-hmm. I wasn't lying. Now, according to your standard, that's verified mail. I did not receive it. Mm-hmm. Here I am talking to an agent. I got very upset, so I walked over to my neighbor's mailbox, and I understand that this is a felony for doing this, but I opened up the mailbox. There were my two letters sitting in there. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's why I'm looking at this right now and wondering, I didn't hear this, Reverend.
We're going to delete that part of the tape.
That's fine. I've been in worse. But that's why I would like to see something that addresses exactly what Representative Holberg brings up, because just verified is not good enough.
And Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, certainly, as I mentioned, this is a work in progress, and we can continue to have these conversations as we have additional committee steps. And I believe that our testifier has some experience with the verified mail piece and would like to...
Okay, well, if you can be very quick about that, Mr. McCann, because then if Mr. Elwood and Mr. Anderson can come up and be ready to testify, because we're running short on time.
I will. Thank you, Mr. McCann. Chair and committee, we've had experience when we've gotten sent out certified mails through the post office, and that's the only form of what we use. We have not gotten our green cards back, and they've been lost, so we have no proof of delivery that they even made it even in that case. So what we have to do then is start back over again or negotiate with that tenant if we can, to try and do something, because then legally we can't sell their property. The email notification is another added tool that we can use either or, so that if we can't reach them by certified email, we at least have a backup plan, because right now we don't. And I've had it happen probably 30% of my time this year, and my green cards have not come back through the Postal Service. We're working with them on trying to rectify that, but this really is a big problem for us in being able to try and follow that timeline. Our goal is, at the end of the day, like I said, is to get people back their stuff. But if we can't, we also want to get space ready to rent to someone else that can come in. So it's kind of a cart before the horse, but we do need to make sure it's done correctly, and we are looking for some options based on new technology.
Thank you, Mr. McCann. Mr. Elwood, if you can come down. Mr. Anfinson, if you can come down and introduce yourself for the record.
Hi.
Please introduce yourself to the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Now that you know who I represent, you're going to conclude that I'm basically here to testify against streamlining and modernizing this law by encouraging you to keep notices in newspapers. And in fact, that's not my purpose. My purpose is to persuade you that for some types of information, newspapers still remain by far the most effective medium for conveying that information to the people who need to hear about it. And so that, I think, is very true of this case. The first thing I want to do is thank Representative Halverson for her cooperation on this issue. She has talked to us extensively about looking for options for some sort of reasonable compromise. And those conversations are continuing and will continue. This is a bill, a work in progress. I also want to thank the proponents of the legislation who have been similarly receptive to our efforts to find a compromise. We will continue to do that. But to the bill, we only are talking here about the public notice provision, which the bill and the including the delete everything would remove. It would remove the historical commitment to public notice in newspapers. Is that a good thing? In some cases it is. But in this case, it's not. If you understand what the public notice for property and self-storage facilities really is aimed at doing, it's not especially aimed at reaching the person whose property is in the facility, okay? For the reasons you've already discussed a bit, many of those people are no longer going to get any kind of notice. They're either overseas in the military, they become ill, they become mentally infirm, they've died. Those people aren't going to get noticed by any means. What public notice in a newspaper does better than any other medium is gets the notice out to a community. And we are all members of communities. And when people in a community see these public notices, you would be amazed. You would be amazed at how often a chain of connections begins. I saw your name. I saw something referring to you. They call somebody else. The word gets back to friends, to relatives, to acquaintances, who then can inform others who may have an interest in this property. If you look, if you do some research, there are some extremely disturbing stories around the country where people have lost not so much things of monetary value, but items of tremendous personal value. Family heirlooms, photographs, things like that, that have been sold off because no one knew they were there because the person who'd put them there was gone, wasn't in a position to get noticed. That's what we're looking at. There's a tendency to think the internet can do everything for us. And 15 years of experience shows how invalid that is in certain specific cases. I don't have a problem with the internet, and I would point out in passing here that newspapers around the state have some of the best websites in the information world. And all of our notices that are published in newspapers must, by state law, also be placed on our websites. People go to community newspapers. Why? To find out about community information. And that will continue here. That will continue if these notices stay in newspapers. Now, the cost issue is a concern. I respect that. We respect that. But I think to a greater extent than the proponents have suggested, there are ways to reduce and minimize the cost of publication in newspapers. If they would use those options, there's not just one newspaper you have to use here. Many cases you have choices. Many cases you can negotiate those fees. So if those options were used, the cost would not be as significant as you might think. Bottom line, newspaper notice works. It's not going to work every time. It's not going to reach everybody. But it's going to reach people who otherwise would not get notice and their friends and relatives to protect this property. And given how small the cost really is that the best option to eliminate an option, an opportunity for people to get notice of sometimes very important property?
Thank
Mr. Chairman, we will continue to work with the author and the proponents on language to resolve our concerns.
Thank you for working with the author, Mr. Amundson. We're not going to take questions until we hear from Mr. Elwood. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank also very much Representative Halverson for reaching out to us, and also the proponents for their graciousness in sending us the drafts and working with us on the bill. I'll just say this. We just want to make sure that the ability of the owners to recoup their costs are balanced against ensuring the opportunity for consumers to redeem their personal property. In many cases, in our clients' cases, that's their entire life. For instance, we serve many people who are victims of violence and domestic violence, and that's where their life is stored. We also just want to make sure that the due process continues as it is today to be robust, and that the procedures for conducting the sale do not impair the existing opportunities for folks and their families to keep their possessions. So we still have the substantive and technical concerns, but we've been assured that we'll be continued to work with the proponents and the author, and we very much look forward to working to get to a place where this works for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Elwood, are there any other remaining questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know I came in late, and I apologize if this was addressed, but when they came to see me in my office, I talked to them about potentially putting something in the contract where there would be a second contact. Is that been addressed in this draft, or will it be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hellstrom, we did mention it, but I think it bears mentioning again because I think it's a really important point. And we didn't make the 24-hour rule an amendment for this, but I have every intention of adding in that provision in the future for the very reasons that were talked about, that people are moving around in new and different ways. People are aging. People are maybe having a crisis in their life. And if they have empowered secondary notifications, that's a much more direct way to get to a consumer who may be defaulting as opposed to hoping that we even see it in a newspaper or in a public notice. So I think it's an additional layer of protection for consumers, and I intend to offer that as we move forward.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I sit in and listen to this, I too had this discussion with some of the folks that were on promoting this. And as I sit here, I have to take into consideration the access cost for this information. I purchased a new laptop this week, and I still can't figure out what they did with Windows 8, but that's a whole nother rant. Mr. Chair, I hate Windows 8. Anyway, the minimum cost for electronic to get online to get these notices for like a small handheld tablet device is about $200. The minimum cost to get these notices via newspaper is about 50 cents. So I just wanted to make sure that we take this into consideration, the information access cost alone. If you have the smallest and cheapest form of email access and you're using a free site, you're still looking at a significant cost compared to like my hometown newspaper, which is free. So these are considerations that we need to make sure that we keep. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Any other questions for the committee? Then, with no other questions, Chair renews this motion that House File 2598, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection. Between here and there, we have assurances of the testifiers that they will continue to work on this bill to iron out the wrinkles. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Allen, if you would take the gavel. Members may recall that we heard this bill, Public Benefit Corporation, in the last committee hearing, but we did not have a bill number. And so at this time, I would like to move House File 2582. But I also have an A4 amendment, so I would ask, I would move the A4 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape that I want, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh moves the that the House File 2582, the amendment, be approved with the bill in form that Arthur wants. Is there any discussion regarding this? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could the author please explain what the amendment does?
No, Ms. Lowe, can you explain what the amendment does?
Sure. the amendment merely reorders a couple of sections in the legislation to just make them work a little bit more logically, and then it clarifies just the use of two words. We originally used the words actually create, and it just changes it to pursue and create. So it's a very non-substantial change. It just makes it cleaned up so it works better for us when it ends up going, the lawyers, when it ends up going into our statutory regimes.
And Ms. Lowe, would you introduce yourself and where you're from, please? Thank you.
I'm Kim Lowe. I'm a shareholder at Frederickson & Byron. I was here on Friday. I am a member of the Minnesota State Bar Association Nonprofit Orgs Committee, as well as the Business Law Section Committee, and I chaired the working group that drafted this legislation for all of you. I'm also a professor at Hamlin Law School, where I teach nonprofits, as well as a small business nonprofit clinic. I also co-chair an ABA task force on social ventures for the American Bar Association as well.
And Madam Chair, I did speak with Ms. Mullen about this amendment too, and she assured me it's a technical amendment, so I didn't get that far into it.
Representative Neuber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for point of clarification, that this amendment, the word change was changed from where inserted was changed from produce to pursue. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
No further discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those against, say no. So moved.
Then with that, for the bill as amended, Madam Chair, what I was asked is, consider we had a lengthy and vigorous discussion on this bill in the last hearing. I would ask that Ms. Lowe just do a preview, a recap, rather, of what the bill is, so then we could move on to hopefully taking some action on this.
Sure. Madam Chair.
Ms. Lowe.
When we were here on Friday, the bill was introduced. I just wanted to back us up and make sure that everybody, all of you understand how this bill works within the framework that we have within our corporate law structure. This Act, or the benefit, Public Benefit Corporation Act, is actually an overlay on top of what we refer to as what's referred to as 302A, which is the For-Profit Corporation Act. Entities that are formed or businesses that are formed as benefit corporations will be for-profit organizations subject to the same rules and the same tax laws as any other for-profit business formed under Minnesota law. The only difference will be that an entity or business formed under 304A or 302A with a 304A overlay will have an additional social purpose. And that social purpose is really at the election of the entrepreneur or the shareholders, and that group of people will craft that purpose to allow them to add that additional social purpose on top of their for-profit activities. I don't know if that was clear last week when we discussed this. So these businesses will operate just like any other for-profit business that we currently have. One question that was posed last week was whether or not these businesses would be able to lobby or what have you. These will be subject to the exact same tax regime, any other sort of governance regime as any other for-profit business. So to the extent a for-profit business can do that, one of these entities can do that as well. 21.
So, Madam Chair, I would just add that we currently have Minnesota corporations that are incorporating in other states because 21 other states have already done this. It is active, this legislation, in other states, and Minnesota kind of needs to get on the bandwagon because this is the direction that business is going in the United States. Not for a majority, but for a select niche of corporations that want to do this, and we don't want to deny Minnesota corporations the ability to incorporate here at home.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. I'm just sitting here contemplating, like I said in other committees, I look for unintended consequences. Right now in Minnesota, a lot of nonprofits assist the state in a lot of grants and a lot of programs for some of the needy people in the community. As this bill goes, would those companies be also eligible to administer some of these grants that the state do?
I would defer, Madam Chair, that question to Ms. Lowe because she does practice in this area of nonprofits, and I think it's probably a good question. So,
Ms. Lowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, these entities are like any other for-profit entity. They are not going to receive grants from foundations or from the government. That is really not what they're structured to do. They will not interrupt the activities of the nonprofit sector and the work that the nonprofit sector does, nor will they anticipate receiving the same sources of funding as the nonprofit sector. When we drafted this legislation, we were very, very conscious of making sure that those sectors aren't overlapping and are not cannibalizing each other. So we recognize, as lawyers and as representatives of many types of organizations, for-profit, nonprofit, that we need to draft legislation that keeps those healthy regimes in place, but also creates an opportunity for entrepreneurs here who want to do something a little different, who want to appeal to maybe a different type of investor, not an investor who would necessarily put their money in a state or a grant recipient, but an investor, a shareholder, who wants to put his or her money towards a for-profit endeavor that has a social aspect to it as well.
And Madam Chair, I would add, for these public benefit corporations, these folks who put these together, there's a market for what they're selling. With respect to nonprofits, it's a different deal. They are largely at the whim of foundations that they have to convince to give them money, or if they want to try to do it some other way, a public fundraising, for example, they can do that too. But you go out and convince them that public benefit corporations are people who are interested in making a profit, and there are people that are willing to give them money for their product too. It's just that this extra piece is the niche they have for how they want to run their business, and also could be part of their market strategy as well.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know you're getting to it, because I wasn't able to attend last Friday because of the short notice and being previously committed. But and that helped just your statement here just a bit. But can you expound on why we need this? I guess I'm if you have a for-profit corporation that's operating, and you can start any corporation to do this business, why do we need a public benefit overlay on top of the existing structure that we already have? I guess I'm trying to grapple with, if you say we already have this in place and it's going to operate like any other entity, why do we need an overlay for a public? I don't understand. If we already have that structure in place, why do we need something on top of it?
I understand the question. And Madam Chair, the fundamental reason is this, is because the standard to which the current existing corporation by which it is measured is maximization of profit. So if I'm running Target, I say, you know what, the new mission of Target is going to be to be a discount retailer in all these states, but we're also going to save the whales too. And I start spending all this money on saving the whales. Then the minority shareholders, or all the shareholders for that matter, get together and sue us back to the Stone Age because we're not doing our job, which is maximizing a profit. In a public benefit corporation, if we want to do something else that's good, then it's more difficult for the shareholders to come back and say, wait a second, you didn't tell us you were going to do green energy, which isn't as profitable as mining or other types of mineral exploration, and so, you know, we're going to see, well, they couldn't do it because we told you we're going to do green energy. That's part of the public benefit corporation. That's why.
Representative Liebling.
Can I follow up? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
But Representative Lesh, can we not, can they not today, as a corporation, identify that that's what their mission is and go after that, that they're going to make a profit at saving the whales? Could they not develop their corporation with their mission statement saying, I'm going to be Target, and my new mission statement now, or I want to be Bullseye, and my mission statement is to save those whales, and I'm going to make a profit saving those whales? Could I not have my corporation defined as that today without this?
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, two things. First of all, and Ms. Lowe could probably answer this better, but for one thing, if you did that, I suspect you wouldn't get the shareholders and the profit you were originally trying to get. But second of all, the principle of a shareholder suit would be to nitpick the heck out of how you were doing that And you would still lose substantially. So they could say, well, no, it's really my intent to make a profit saving the whales, but look at what you did here, 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 and here. None of those prospects have any chance of making any money whatsoever, and so you're going to lose your lawsuit. But Ms. Lowe?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, this question comes up pretty regularly on a pretty regular basis, so if my answer sounds pat, it's because I've answered it many times. First of all, Representative Lesh indicated that there are 21 other states that have passed legislation like this. Minnesota, there's also a whole host of states, probably 10 right now, that are also doing the same thing we are, anticipating passing legislation like this. So at some point, we are going to need to recognize that other states are doing this, and so we need to make sure that we know how to treat these entities from when they're formed in Wisconsin or another state and they come here, first of all. Second of all, you are absolutely correct. In a closely held business, the shareholders could identify a mission, have that baked into their contractual arrangement that they have amongst themselves, and commit to doing that. The problem with that, or the reality of that, is they would have to pay me a great deal of money to craft an entity that has contractual arrangements that are bulletproof, that will withstand a lawsuit and will withstand a challenge. This legislation is meant to allow the average citizen, the average entrepreneur who wants to do this, to have a mechanism to be able to do this. Not all our business owners are target. Not all of our business owners are wealthy, well-financed, multinational organizations. We have many small businesses. We have many multi-generational businesses. We have many startup businesses that care about this, and they shouldn't have to engage sophisticated expense. They can come pay me. I'll be happy to do it. But they shouldn't have to be able to do this. And that's the purpose of this legislation, is to give entrepreneurs the ability to use this sort of legislation to make this choice and to do it easily, but also to overlay a construct so that we know, that you know, that these are the rules that they've agreed to follow. Because if I just do it contractually, there are no rules. It's really just the contract that the shareholders have agreed to, and there's no public disclosure. There's no transparency to expectations.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. We'll take two more questions, and we have to move on because the time is running out here for get a session. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be real quick. And just first of all, Ms. Lowe, thank you very much for working on this. I assume you put in a lot of volunteer hours and really appreciate that. I think it's very interesting. I also, unfortunately, missed the other meeting. I was in another committee. But I just want to ask you really quickly, how will the public know what the form is of a particular corporation? Is that in the name, or how does that get communicated?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a great question. There's a couple of communication mechanisms involved with this overlay. First of all, an organization that elects to be a public benefit corporation would have that added onto their name. So right now we have INCs or LLCs. These sort of entities would be called PBCs or GBCs or SPCs. They'll have a label on them that will notify the public that they've agreed to this sort of contract, this structure. Their organizational documents, in order to create these types of entities, they're filed with the Secretary of State. Those articles are available. You can order them. You can get them. The third, probably the most important mechanism that's built into this statute, which is unique amongst the statutes that have been passed throughout the different states, is we have a reporting mechanism, an annual report, that these public benefit corporations will file with the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State will make that annual report available to people who request it. That annual report will require public benefit corporations to report against what they said they're going to do. They will say whatever their proclaimed purposes, they will report against that. It's like a report card. They have to file it every year. If they fail to file it, they'll lose that status as a benefit corporation. We have no other entities in our mix of corporate entities that do this. For-profit companies do not have to, unless they're public, but that's a different regime, do not file their financial statements. They do not file what they do. They don't disclose that. Our nonprofit organizations file complicated 990s with the IRS if they're tax exempt. Those are generally available on GuideStar, but there's no reporting mechanism that exists at the state level for what they're doing. These entities would have that reporting mechanism so that people who value that brand commitment or that commitment to a social purpose will be able to see every year what those organizations have done. And that's part of the contract.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lowell, I've started four corporations in my life. The last one I just formed was just last month. And the one I started just 2 years ago, I already promised a percentage of my profits to a I could consider it a social benefit program. What I'm trying to understand is, should I have maybe organized my last corporation as a social benefit corporation, despite the fact that I am making profit and have already pledged part of my profits to a social purpose?
Ms. Lowe.
Madam Chair, well, since you formed it a couple of years ago, you wouldn't have been able to make you wouldn't not have been able to form that sort of entity either under Minnesota law or probably other state laws. This is a relatively new entity, relatively new form that's sweeping across the nation. But it's important to recognize that a lot of corporations, a lot of business owners make these commitments to give certain amounts of money away to promote social purposes. This entity form is meant to be a public public differentiator, to allow people to publicly state that this is what they want to do. And they recognize that people, the entrepreneurs that want to use this, to them, this public disclosure of their purpose, their social purpose, is a value. Now, I personally, I don't know about you, I don't want the public in my business. And if I want to make a tax-deductible donation to some charitable organization, that's fine. But for some entrepreneurs, this public this public statement, this public contract, is very important. And I won't go into generational differences, but I think we are dealing with a generation of new upcoming entrepreneurs to whom this is a very important aspect of their contract with society and how they want to function within society.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. Members, we have to keep this short. We remember that we did have an informational hearing on this. We do have just one more person on here. Do you have a follow-up question, Representative Neuberger, or a...
Madam Chair, I do have a follow-up question to my last.
Representative Johnson? Or Anderson, I'm sorry.
On the reason.
Thank you. Close enough. I get it. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lowe, I'm still trying to really understand. Became law, I could reorganize. But still, I can still accomplish under my existing corporation exactly everything that you are proposing here. Everything can be done. The people that are going to be receiving the benefits to my donation, it's going to be the exact same thing. I've already publicly pledged this to happen. I don't need a new law to do this. But my follow-up question is that, okay, I see 20 different states listed here, plus the District of Columbia. I would like to see a list of some of the corporations that have been formed in some of these states. And I know you probably do not have that with you today. But in the meantime, could you list off some of these corporations that have formed in some of these states?
Ms. Lowe.
Madam Chair, on Friday we talked about one of those that recently is a Minnesota corporation, Rasmussen College, that just reorganized themselves as a benefit corporation under Delaware law. They are a homegrown organization, a homegrown privately held for-profit school. They cannot reorganize themselves under the statute like this here because we don't have one. A few weeks ago they reorganized under the Delaware statute because that was part of that's how they felt that this is important to their going forward operations. So that's one that it's right here. There's plenty of other organizations, Patagonia. There's a lot of them across the country that have sort of taken up this belief in that this is important to them. One thing I do want to respond to is we have acknowledged as lawyers that you could do whatever you want with a corporate structure. You can create any sort of contractual arrangement amongst your shareholders that you want to do if you pay for lawyers to do it. The purpose of this legislation is to allow the average citizen, the average entrepreneur who might want to go online and just form their own company on the Secretary of State's website to do that and not have to worry about being exposed to the minority shareholder suits or some of the claims that would arise if they did it themselves and didn't have the legal protections that the statute is meant to cover.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. Okay, I'm going to move now the bill. This is going to go to Commerce and many of those questions will be answered and addressed in that committee. And we did, I think we've spent almost 45 minutes or more on this bill. Mm-hmm. I move that Representative Lesh's bill, House File 2582, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection Finance. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those against say no.
No.
So moved.
Did you say that passes, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Fisher, if you can come on down. I move that Representative Fisher's bill, House File 2616, be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Representative Fisher, we don't have a lot of time for this bill, so we're going to try to get through this as best we can, and if we have to come back on it, that's what we'll do. But if you could please present your bill. Representative Fisher, I know you have Bob Meyer from the DNR here. Who, if he's going to present it, that's fine too, but in the interest of time, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I also have Julie Eckman in the audience to help answer any questions. Very quickly, this bill does several different things. It allows, number one, for tamper-resistant meters on wells, bans once through cooling, addresses the reduction of stormwater fees in certain areas, but the big focus that is for this committee is it establishes an administrative hearing concept so that when there are violations of permit, the DNR are able to address with it. Right now, when there's a violation, it ends up having to go to the county court system, and it ends up being a penalty of somewhere between $50 and $750. That is not a very large amount. I was in a committee right before this upstairs where that in just the reporting method, they're saying there's between 400 and 800 violations each year. People just aren't filing the reports on time. So as a result, because of the low threshold that a number of businesses are, or some businesses are deciding that instead of complying, they're feeling that with the low threshold of penalties, that they just see it as a cost of business and will continue to violate what the law is. And so we're trying to put in a method that's a little bit easier and makes the penalties a little bit more appropriate for what's happening. And at that point, very quickly, questions.
Thank you. Questions from members. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering why we're hearing this bill before it goes to a policy committee. Shouldn't the policy be discussed in and of itself before we discuss the penalties?
I'm sorry. Would you repeat a question again,
sure.
Representative Scott?
Why would this bill not have gone to a policy committee first? The policy needs to be right before we examine what the penalties are. To me, it should have gone to a policy committee first.
Okay. Well,
which is, the Environment Policy Committee.
Representative Scott, the length of this legislative session, the shortness of deadlines, I'm not sure if that's the reason why things have gotten referred in different ways. This is technically a policy committee, not a finance committee. Representative Fisher, did you want to respond to that?
Basically, I know that this was also being heard at the same time upstairs as an informational hearing in the Environment Committee. Also, on top of that, the area that we're looking at here is giving the administrative hearing capability in here. And that's something that comes through civil law first. And it'd be kind of, it was kind of cart before the horse. Do we come here first or we don't go to the Environment Committee and try to get that heard and then come over here and see if we're going to be, what the questions and concerns are with the administrative law part?
Okay. Well, there's one deadline for all policy bills unless they involve financing. So I didn't see that as being a major issue. But Representative Scott?
No. Okay.
Other questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, I think it is kind of difficult not knowing what the range of fees and et cetera are to ascertain whether they're appropriate. This could all change when it goes through the other committee. But so tell me what I always shudder when I see a choice of two penalties and that the mandate is whichever is higher. So what's the highest penalty you could get under this?
Representative Fisher.
Under the one that's being proposed right now?
Well,
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, with the language that's in front of the Civil Law Committee right now, what's the highest penalty somebody would have to pay?
Representative Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Committee, Representative Holbert, the highest penalty that is being proposed right now will be a $20,000 penalty.
And, Mr. Chair?
Representative Holbert.
What would you have to do to get a $20,000 penalty, and is there any discretion? I mean, it seems like it's the higher that the judge doesn't have any discretion, and that's concerning as well.
I could turn that over to my counterpart to try to answer that.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Meyer, Director of Policy and Government Relations for the DNR. This administrative penalty order authority we're seeking would allow us some flexibility in establishing these fees. The $20,000 maximum would be for the most egregious violator that would be out there for a repeat offense, somebody that we've been trying to work with and continues to do appropriate water illegally. That would be the maximum. I really don't see that coming into play at all. The purpose of having the APO authority versus just going to the courts is to provide us flexibility to work with that person to get them into compliance faster in a more efficient manner.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, two quick questions. Is this an agency bill, and aren't these new penalties that you're getting the authority to assess?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, the bill comes from a report that we submitted to the legislature asking the department to recommend additional tools for groundwater enforcement and appropriation management activities. So the penalties, there's already, Mr. Chairman, members, there's already a penalty in place for violations of these sections of law. However, it goes to the courts, and the courts' fine structures are different, and then the county attorney has to charge that case. So what we're trying to find is some consistency across all jurisdictions in the enforcement, rather than having to rely on the individual prosecutor to help determine what that penalty fee might be.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer, aren't these penalties new, though, that are being proposed?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, the administrative penalty would be new, but currently there is a fine, and it is against the law to do these things.
And Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry this is taking so long, but isn't the current fine structure far less than what we're looking at in this bill?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, it is. But again, this is up to $20,000, and we aren't wed to that number, so to speak. So,
well, Mr. Chair, I'm relieved to hear that they're not wed to the number, but again, we're sitting here in civil law. We don't know what the policy and fines are going to be proposed in the Environment and Ag Committee, and it makes it really difficult to ascertain whether the process is appropriate for what we're looking at. So
understood, Representative Holbert. That said, I try to afford wide latitude and consideration of these items. When we look at these, that is a matter that is really left for the Environment Committee to decide the level of appropriateness of those fines. It's not really the purview of the Civil Law Committee. I understand you're going to have an opinion on that when you sit here, but to the extent there's some overlapping jurisdiction, I defer to the committee that has primary jurisdiction. Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just make a point. Depending on the level of fine and the structure and the exposure to property owners and business might inform this committee on whether or not they were comfortable with an administrative process versus a full-blown court process. And so that's my point.
Fair enough, Representative Holbert. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair. I have some concerns on this, especially with the high penalty they're putting, $20,000. In the court system, the $400 to $700 range is a misdemeanor, maybe a gross misdemeanor fine level. The $20,000 is a multi-year felony level, if it would be in court for that amount of fine. So you're taking a misdemeanor and giving it administrative, basically a felony level penalty.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's important to realize this language that is in this bill is almost a duplicate of what the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health has right now. If you look at Subdivision 2 on 6.1, it goes through the process that would be used in determining the amount of the penalty that may be considered. And then also on top of page 7, Subdivision 5, it provides for a process to reduce that penalty to only cover our administrative costs for pursuing the action if the violator comes into compliance. So what we're looking for is a tool to bring people into compliance, not to hit them over the head with a hammer, but to use the power of the pocketbook, so to speak, to help them come into compliance more quickly. We view this as a flexible tool to help us work with people to understand what they need to do, rather than as a onerous kind of penalty process. So,
Representative Hillstrom, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make it clear that it will end up coming through the Judiciary Committee as well before we give up the court's jurisdiction over this, so you'll have another time to discuss it.
Representative Johnson, do you have other? You're okay. Okay. Representative Howe.
And thank you.
And well, I have two other folks on the list, Representative Howe and Representative Scott. So we'll decide depending on the length of the questions what we're going to do about this one today. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess having seen a number of these faces that we're going to be looking at here, and I guess my concern is we don't know what the penalty structure is going to look like. I have some grave concern, having in my previous life worked with MPCA numerous times on leaks of storage tanks and that type of thing, and it really bothers me to the fact that we're going to go down that lane, because I'd hate to see the DNR go down the same lane and the same public scrutiny as the MPCA does when they come in, because they do when they come in. It's my opinion they come in with a hammer, and this gives the same hammer availability to the DNR, and in my jurisdiction and in my district that I represent, I don't think they're very comfortable with that. That being said, with the current structure of and discussions we're having in my district with water appropriations, I've got real grave concerns that when I've got farmers that get their irrigators, they can't even turn the switch on them after putting in a $100,000 investment. I tell you what, I think we need to fix some of the things that are already coming down the pipe before we start worrying about how we're going to slap them alongside the head with a large $20,000 fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Howe. And members, considering the number of the questions that we have on this bill, it's the intention of the Chair to lay this bill over until the next hearing so that we can give it the due time and the questions that's appropriate to it. So if you can come back next time, Representative Fisher, I don't know. It's room 10 tomorrow at 8:15. So we change rooms. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.